Harry usually looked very happy when he came in the front door from work. I don't think he ever was truly happy, of course, but he always looked like it. And this was one of my first very important lessons from him. Make your face fit the occasion. It may seem like a small and obvious point, but to a fledgling monster still figuring out that he was very different, it was a vital lesson. I remember sitting in the great banyan tree in our front yard one afternoon because, frankly, that is what the other kids in the neighborhood did, even long after what one might call optimum tree-climbing age. Those trees were a great place to sit, with their wide horizontal branches, and they served as a clubhouse for everyone under the age of 18. So I sat in mine that afternoon, hoping the rest of the neighborhood would mistake me for normal. I was at an age when everything was starting to change, and I had begun to notice that I was changing in a very different way. For one thing, unlike the other boys, I was not totally consumed with trying to see under Bobby Gelber's skirt when she climbed up into the tree. And for another, when the dark passenger started whispering wicked thoughts, I realized that it was a presence that had always been there. It just hadn't spoken until now. But now, when my contemporaries were starting to pass around copies of Hustler, it was sending me dreams of a different kind of illustration, perhaps from Vivisection Monthly. And although the images that came to me were disturbing at first, they started to seem more and more natural, inevitable, desirable, and finally, necessary. But another voice, equally strong, told me this was wrong, crazy, very dangerous. And for the most part, the two voices fought to a tie, and I did nothing but dream, just like all the human boys my age. But one wonderful night, the two whispering armies came together when I realized that the Gelber's dog, Buddy, was keeping Mom awake with its non-stop barking. And this was not a good thing. Mom was dying of some untreatable, mysterious thing called a lymphoma, and she needed her sleep. And it occurred to me that if I could help Mom sleep, this would be a very good thing. And both voices agreed that this was so. One, somewhat reluctantly, of course, but the other, darker one, with an eagerness that made me dizzy. And so it was that Buddy, the loud-mouthed little dog, launched Dexter on his way. It was clumsy, of course, and much messier than I had planned on, but it was also, oh, so good and right and necessary. In the following months, there were a few more minor experiments, carefully spaced, playmates more carefully chosen, since even in my hot-blooded phase of self-discovery, I understood that if all the pets in the neighborhood disappeared, someone was bound to ask questions. But there was a stray, and a bicycle trip to a different area, and somehow young Luke Darkwalker got by, slowly learning to be happily me. And because I felt so attached to my small experiments, I buried them close at hand, behind a row of bushes in our backyard. I certainly know better than that now. But at the time, everything seemed so innocent and wonderful, and I wanted to look out at the bushes and bask in the warm glow of the memories from time to time. And I had made my first mistake. And so, that lazy afternoon, I sat in my banyan tree and watched as Harry parked the car, got out, and paused. He had on his work face, the one that said, "I've seen it all and don't like most of it." And he stood beside the car for a long moment with his eyes closed, doing nothing more complicated than breathing. When he opened his eyes again, he had an expression on his face that said, "I'm home, and feel very good about that." He took a step toward the front door, and I jumped down out of the tree and went to him.
"Dexter," he said, "how was your day at school?"
In truth, It had been just about like all the others, but even then I knew that wasn't the appropriate response.
Good, I said. We're studying communism.
Harry nodded. That's important to know about, he said. What's the capital of Russia?
Moscow, I said. It used to be St. Petersburg.
Really? Said Harry. Why did they change it?
I shrugged. They're atheists now, I said. They can't have a saint anything, because they don't believe in them.
He put a hand on my shoulder, and we started walking to the house. That can't be much fun, he said.
Didn't you, fight communists?
I asked him, wanting to say kill, but not quite daring.
In the Marines?
Harry nodded. That's right, he said. Communism threatens our way of life, so it's important to fight it. We were at the front door, and he gently pushed me in ahead of him, into the smell of the fresh coffee that Doris, my adoptive mom, always had ready for Harry when he came home from work. She was not yet too sick to move, and she was waiting for him in the kitchen. They went through their ritual of drinking coffee and talking quietly, as they did every day, and it was such a perfect Norman Rockwell picture that I would certainly have forgotten it almost instantly, if not for what happened later that evening. Doris was already in bed. She had taken to going to sleep earlier and earlier as her cancer got worse, and she needed more pain medicine. Harry, Deborah, and I had gathered in front of the TV set, as we usually did. We were watching a sitcom, I don't remember which. There were so many of them at the time that they all could have been lumped together under the title of Funny Minority and the White Guy. The whole purpose of all these shows seemed to be letting us all know that in spite of our small differences, we were really all the same. I kept waiting for some clue that this might include me, but neither Freddie Prinze nor Red Fox ever chopped up a neighbor. Still, everyone else seemed to enjoy the show. Deborah laughed out loud now and then, and Harry kept a contented smile on his face, and I did my best just to keep a low profile and fit in amid the hilarity. But in the middle of the climactic scene, right when we were about to learn that we are all the same and then hug, the doorbell rang. Harry frowned a little bit, but he got up and went to the door with one eye still on the TV. Since I had already guessed how the show would end, and I wasn't particularly moved by artificial hugs of compassion, I watched Harry. He turned on the outside light, peeked through the eye hole, and then unlocked and opened the door.
Gus, he said with surprise. Come on in.
Gus Rigby was Harry's oldest friend on the force. They had been best man at each other's wedding, and Harry was godfather to Gus's daughter, Betsy. Since his divorce, Gus was always at our house for holidays and special occasions, although not as often now that Doris was sick, and he always brought a key lime pie. But he didn't look terribly social now, and he wasn't carrying a pie. He looked angry and frazzled, and he said,
"We gotta talk,"
and pushed past Harry into the house.
"About what?"
Harry said, still holding the door open. Gus turned and snarled at him.
"Otto Valdez is out on the street."
Harry stared at him.
"How did he get out?"
"That lawyer he's got," Gus said. "He said it was excessive force."
Harry nodded.
"You were rough on him, Gus."
"He's a baby raper," Gus said. "You want me to kiss him?"
"All right,"
Harry said. He closed and locked the door.
"What is there to talk about?"
he said.
"He's after me now," Gus said. "The phone rings and nobody's there, just breathing. But I know it's him. And I got a note under my front door. At my home, Harry."
"What did the lieutenant say?"
Gus shook his head.
"I want to do this myself," he said. "On the side. And I want your help."